नमो ओं विष्णुपदाय कृष्णपृष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदांत स्वामी निति नामिने नमस्ते सरस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्यादिशत हरे कृष्ण. Should I take the attendance now? It seems that many are not present as yet. They generally come in a little later. Anyway, Manjari Devi Dasi is here. Everything that happens, every important incident that happens, and recorded chronologically, is called history. So whatever had been happening in the Vaishnav movement, as we discussed from the beginning of creation, is the history of Vaishnav culture. And that is what our heritage is. Krishna consciousness movement is not just a new movement that started only 30 years back, or 33 years ago, but this movement actually started at the very beginning of creation. And not only at the time of creation it started, it actually exists eternally in the spiritual sky. Every living entity in his constitutional position is a Vaishnav. One ceases to be a Vaishnav only when he becomes conditioned by the material nature. And that is what our heritage is. Krishna consciousness is not just a new movement or a cult. It is an age-old, eternally existing spiritual characteristics of the living entities. Now, we were considering how Krishna consciousness began in this universe. We all are acquainted with that concept, how it began. It began at the time of creation, when Brahma was confused, then Krishna came and gave this Krishna consciousness to him. And until yesterday we discussed how this movement had been spreading or has been continuing through the cyclic succession from Brahma to Narada, and then it continued. And there had been some decline from time to time. When irreligiosity prevailed, then the Vaishnav culture became obscured to some extent. And whenever this Vaishnav culture became obscured, then the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself came to re-establish this Vaishnav culture. And that is the purpose of his incarnation. And in this way, time actually moves on a higher concept through the yugas: Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, and Kali Yuga. In Satya Yuga, dharma is very, very intact. People are pious. And people are pious means people follow the principles of Vaishnav culture. The true dharma is actually Vaishnav dharma. Impersonalism, although is recognized as the dharma in India since the recent past, but impersonalism is not really the dharma. Shaivites, Shaktas, they are not really the followers of religious principles. They are kind of deviations. The real dharma is Vaishnav dharma. To be surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the dharma. Dharma doesn't mean to put up someone else as the competitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and follow him. That's what the Shaivites and Shaktas do. Yesterday I intended to touch that part, but I deliberately avoided because it kind of takes up a lot of time. But anyway, briefly I'll describe. Shaivites means the followers of Lord Shiva, and Shaktas means the worshippers of Devi, the female form of the expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mahamaya. The energy, the personification of the external energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the cause of the material creation, or who is the controller of this material creation. The Lord glances towards Mahamaya and the material nature becomes manifest. So that form of Mahamaya, or that personality Mahamaya, is the worshippers, the worshipable deity of the Shaktas, or worshippers of Shakti or energy, power. So, in modern Vedic concept, the Shaivites and Shaktas, the worshippers of Lord Shiva and worshippers of Devi, are considered to be followers of religion. But if we consider from a pure Vedic point of view, then we see that they are not really the followers of Dharma. It's a kind of a deviation from Dharma. The true Dharma is to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead and become the devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There cannot possibly be any compromise. And of course, it's not that we are forbidding people from worshipping Shiva or Devi, but they have to be worshipped with the right understanding. And the right understanding is that Shiva is a Vaishnava and Devi is a Vaishnava. Durga, Kali, all these forms are Vaishnavis. Now, worshipping them as Vaishnavas is all right. There's nothing wrong in it. Because worshipping them as Vaishnav means, just as a Vaishnav worships another exalted Vaishnav, the devotees do worship them. But the difference between these worshippers of Lord Shiva as a Vaishnav and the Shaivites is the Shaivites, or the so-called followers of Lord Shiva, put up Lord Shiva as the competitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Similarly, the Shaktas put up Kali as the competitor of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But the real worship should be done with the understanding that they are devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And in that worship, there is nothing wrong, rather it is advantageous. It is advantageous to worship them as Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis. Now, this spiritual culture, the Vedic culture, went on through Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dwapar Yuga, practically unhindered. Because whenever there was difficulty, the Supreme Personality of Godhead came and rectified the situation. But the trouble actually starts in the age of Kali. The trouble starts in the age of Kali. And that we discussed briefly yesterday, how Kali actually used the Brahmanas to destroy this Brahminical culture or Vedic culture. The protector, the caretaker, and the executors of Vedic culture are the Brahmanas. But Kali very expertly contaminated the Brahminical culture through the Brahmanas by making demoniac people take birth in the Brahminical families. Those who are actually the executors of the Brahminical culture. They actually became the destroyer of the Brahmin. They were made to become the destroyer of the Brahminical culture. And they introduced all kinds of deviant and abominable activities in the name of Vedic culture. And when, in this way, the Vedic culture was very badly affected and almost destroyed, then the Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared as Lord Buddha. And Lord Buddha made the followers of the Vedic culture reject the Vedas. Now the question may arise, why Krishna appearing as Lord Buddha rejected the Vedas, which is the very foundation of the spiritual culture of this world? The reason was that all kinds of abominable activities, all kinds of sinful activities was going on in the name of Vedic culture, Vedic religion. Therefore, in order to stop that, Buddha told them to reject the Vedas. Actually, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, when he makes his plans are quite extensive. It just doesn't happen all of a sudden. It's not that he just comes and in one moment he rectifies the situation. He takes his time. Because we have to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead deals with eternal time. Therefore, there is no dearth of time in his case. He has all the time. Now, we may become impatient and say, why nothing is happening? And why there is so much difficulties and troubles and nothing is happening? No one is rectifying. But the Lord will take his time and do his job. And it may take a few hundred years, it may take a few generations or even a few hundred years, but it will happen. Now here we can see the Lord's wonderful plan. He came as Lord Buddha, and first thing he did is reject the Vedas. And he said there is no need to follow the Vedas, because in the name of Vedas, all kinds of abominable activities were going on. So he said, no need to follow the Vedas. Therefore, people, those who are involved in those abominable activities in the name of the Vedas, they just gave it up. Gave up those abominable activities. And then he came, then he established some very simple principles of religion. And those, he had 10 principles of becoming, how to become good. That is, always speak the truth, stay on the path of righteousness, do not inflict pain upon others, do not become violent to others, try to be compassionate towards others, and so on and so forth. And he pointed out the goal of life is nirvana. And nirvana means to merge into nothing. That's why his philosophy is known as voidism. So we can see the Vedas are giving the description that there is another reality beyond this material nature, the spiritual reality. And the spiritual and this material nature is a perverted reflection of that spiritual reality. But that concept was totally rejected. And Buddha just pointed out that the goal of life is to become one with nothing, or to become nothing. Ultimately, the goal of life is to become nothing. And he had a whole philosophy to establish that point. And the point is something like, this material nature is full of suffering. So our existence, our body, our entity, is the source of suffering. So when you become nothing, then there won't be any suffering. Sounds convincing, doesn't it? If you don't have any better philosophy than this, then this sounds fine. Yes, our existence is full of, our existence causes misery. So become nothing, so there won't be any misery. So this was Buddha's teachings. And at that time, you'll be surprised to know that entire India practically became Buddhist. The whole of India actually became Buddhist. Brahminical culture was just existing in some pockets. And the tremendous thrust actually came from by the patronage of the king, especially King Ashoka. And the Kshatriyas started to become Buddhists. And around that time, another personality actually came. His name is Mahavir. And Mahavir, he is drawing the line similar to Buddhism, but he is actually drawing the line from Rishabdev. From Rishabdev to King Arhat. King Arhat actually was an imitator of Lord Rishabdev. He saw that Rishabdev was moving around like a madman. He doesn't have any external consciousness. He was not wearing any clothes. He didn't have any awareness of what was going on around him. Yet, thousands of people are following him. So he thought, King Arhat thought, that I am a king, and not so, people are not, although I am a king, people do not really show me this kind of respect. My followers are not really as loyal to me as to this person. So if I start behaving like that person, then people will accept me as a very great personality. So he started to externally imitate Rishabdev. This has been recorded in Srimad Bhagavatam. King Arhat actually was the king of the province of Konka and Venka. And then there were different Tirthankars. Anyway, Mahavir actually drew the line from that. He thought that Buddha is gaining such popularity, and he thought, let me come up with another philosophy which is similar to that, then people will follow me also. And he presented that philosophy, basically the Vaishyas started to follow Mahavir. So in this way, in India, Kshatriyas started to follow Buddha and Vaishyas started to follow Mahavir as their opposition or revolt against the Brahminical culture. So as opposed to the Brahminical culture, they came up with these two ideas. The Kshatriyas generally followed Lord Buddha, and Vaishyas followed Mahavir. So the followers of Mahavir are known as Jains. And you will see in India still today, there are many of the Vaishyas are Jains. Anyway, in this way, India's spiritual culture saw a major deviation from the Vedic culture, from the Vedas. So after Buddhism had been established and the principle of non-violence had been established and the Vedic scriptures had practically been rejected, at that time Shankaracharya came. And Shankaracharya defeated Buddhism. Shankaracharya basically followed one logic that you all speak of Nirvana. He challenged the Buddhists that you all are presenting that the goal of life is Nirvana. And you are saying that Nirvana means to become nothing. But this concept of Nirvana is from the Vedas. And according to the Vedas, Nirvana means to become one with everything. A completely opposite presentation. Nirvana means to merge or become with the Absolute. But that Absolute is impersonal. Now the question may arise, why did Shankaracharya present that philosophy? He presented that philosophy because if he presented the entire Vedic understanding to the Buddhists, then the Buddhists would immediately reject it, saying that, well, I mean, that is your religion, that's completely different from ours, and you just carry on with your religion, we will carry on with our religion. But Shankaracharya's mission was to drive Buddhism out of India. Therefore, he just made this challenge that your Nirvana, the concept of Nirvana is a Vedic concept. And Nirvana means to become one with the ultimate absolute, which is the cause of everything. And everything is that Brahma, the spiritual energy. Now, Shankaracharya, in this way, very expertly, he re-established the Vedic culture. The Vedas, not the Vedic culture, I would say. The Vedas. And then, after Shankaracharya re-established the Vedas and impersonalism had been established, then came Ramanujacharya. And Ramanujacharya established his philosophy known as Vishishtadvaitavad over Shankaracharya's Kevaladvaitavad. The pure Kevaladvaitavad. Kevaladvaitavad. Keval means only. Advaita means non-dual. That is one and which can be termed as absolute monism. But Ramanujacharya established his special concept of non-duality. The spiritual reality is non-dual. But then again, from the material perspective, it is non-dual, it is one. But when we go there, then we find that there is variety. And the way Ramanujacharya defeated Shankaracharya's philosophy is very interesting. Like, Ramanujacharya made a few points. Like, Shankaracharya established that the forms that one worships, like mainly five different forms, form of Vishnu, form of Surya, form of Ganesh, form of Shiva, and form of Devi. These five different forms are actually imaginary. In the initial stage, one cannot meditate upon the void, or meditate upon the impersonal. Therefore, one needs a form. But when one becomes accomplished in meditation, then he doesn't need the forms, he can throw the forms away, and he can meditate upon the impersonal, ultimate, absolute. And Shankaracharya's philosophy was that this nature is actually illusory. You see, impersonalism is also a Vedic concept. At one stage, Vedas do accept impersonalism. That impersonalism of the Vedas is known as Brahma-vad. And Shankaracharya actually established, and that Brahma is the spiritual energy, and that spiritual energy is impersonal, but that energy is transformed into variety, which gives rise to the objects of this material nature. Like Brahma transforms gradually into Pradhan Mahatattva, then mind, intelligence, false ego, then ether, fire, air, water, earth. In this way, their transformation gradually gives rise to this material nature. But Shankaracharya pointed out that actually it is not transformation, because the Absolute cannot be transformed. It is only illusion. So the transformation theory is called Parinambad, transformation of Brahma into material nature. But Shankaracharya established a theory called Vivartavad, or the theory of illusion. Everything is illusion, everything is illusory. And he gave the example that just as one mistakes a rope to be a snake, just as one mistakes a mirage to be water, similarly, this material nature is illusory. So Ramanujacharya said that fine, there may not be the rope may appear to be as a snake. One may mistake the rope to be a snake, but somewhere the snake must be existing. That's why you're mistaking the rope to be a snake. Fine. In the mirage there is no water. We may mistake the mirage to be the water, but somewhere the water must be existing. That's why you're mistaking the mirage to be water. Therefore, we may consider that this is illusory. This is illusory, the existence of the variety of the material nature. But somewhere, this variety must be existing. That's why you're mistaking this nature to be that reality. But Shankaracharya established a theory called Vivartavad, or the theory of illusion. Everything is illusion. Everything is illusory. And he gave the example that just as one mistakes a rope to be a snake, just as one mistakes a mirage to be water, similarly, this material nature is illusory. So Ramanujacharya made the point that fine, there may not be the rope may appear to be as a snake. One may mistake the rope to be a snake, but somewhere the snake must be existing. That's why you're mistaking the rope to be a snake. Fine. In the mirage there is no water. We may mistake the mirage to be the water, but somewhere the water must be existing. That's why you're mistaking the mirage to be water. Therefore, we may consider that this is illusory. This is illusory, the existence of the variety of the material nature. But somewhere, this variety must be existing. That's why you're mistaking this nature to be that reality. So in this way, Ramanujacharya defeated Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya's Kevaladvaitavad. And he established Vishishtadvaitavad. And this is how personalism was established once again. And then came Madhvacharya, and he also made a massive onslaught on Shankaracharya's impersonalism. In this way, Vaishnavism had once again been established, but still there was a conflict. There was a continuous conflict between the impersonalists and the Vaishnavas, Shankaracharya's followers and the Vaishnavas. There were violent attacks, lots of persecution. Ramanujacharya's life was in danger many times. They tried to kill impersonalists tried to kill Ramanujacharya, even when he was just a young boy. It's a very interesting life, actually, Ramanujacharya's life. Same thing with Madhvacharya. But then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu presented the Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva. And in this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu harmonized both the impersonal and the personal concepts. And his point was that Achinta, the subject matter that we are discussing about, is Achinta, beyond our mental concoction, beyond the region of our thoughts, beyond our sense perception. Therefore, the first thing he established that, you know, this subject matter is beyond our sense perception. Therefore, depending upon our sense perception, we'll never be able to come to the right understanding. And Achinta Kholu Je Bhaba Na Tang Starke Na Jo Jayet. And a thing that is beyond our sense perception, beyond the realm of our thoughts, cannot be established by mere arguments and logic. Is it clear? Does it make sense? The things that are beyond our sense perception, can we establish that? Can we understand that with our arguments and logic? No. Therefore, one must accept the evidence of the scriptures and the explanations of the acharyas. And in this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu pointed out that that subject, that region is beyond our sense perception, and the subject is beyond our intellectual verification. Therefore, just accept the authorities of the scriptures and the self-realized souls. And then he established that spiritual reality is one, at the same time different. From one point of view, it is one. From another point of view, it is different. And the subject matter of discussion and consideration are three, basically. Ishvara, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Prakriti, and Jiva. So between Ishvara and Prakriti, there is similarity and difference. From the Jiva and Ishvara, there is similarity and difference. And between Jiva and Prakriti, there is similarity and difference. So in simple words, this is the sum and substance of Achinta Bheda Bheda. So in this way, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu established the Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva, or the perfect Vaishnava understanding. And not only Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave that, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in order to draw everyone into his fold, he started a movement called Sankirtan movement. Then in one hand, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave the highest spiritual philosophy, highest spiritual understanding. But at the same time, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave the process which is very simple and sublime. Whether one understands the philosophy or not, anyone can participate. And that process that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave is just sing and dance and honor Krishna Prasad. A very simple process. He used to have the sessions of chanting and dancing. And after chanting and dancing, a massive distribution of Krishna Prasad, Jagannath Prasad. And after having Jagannath Prasad, again starts another session of chanting and dancing. And in this way, there was a continuous festivity. And by chanting, one actually developed the understanding of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and re-establish his lost relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then the entire philosophy actually became revealed in the heart. This philosophy, the spiritual philosophy, cannot be understood by mere studying of books, but cannot be understood just by some intellectual pursuit. This is revealed in the heart. When one receives the mercy of the Lord, then this understanding is revealed in the heart. And that is the process that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave. And that's why Mahaprabhu himself did not write any books. He simply presented his entire teachings in 8 simple verses, 8 shlokas, Shikshashtakam. Yet, Mahaprabhu's followers, they wrote volumes of books establishing the supremacy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings. So that is how wonderful Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy is. So today I will end here and I'll invite questions. What's that? Oh, I see. Why the Buddhists accepted the teachings of Shankaracharya. It's not that they accepted, but people those days were fairly honest. And when they were defeated, then they accepted the concept. Because they saw that the other person, what he's presenting, is superior to their understanding. So they had to accept. They are not so thick-skinned like the people of today. Like even they are defeated, beaten to the pulp, still they don't want to surrender. But those days people were pretty honest, I would say. Especially in the spiritual sphere. When they would have arguments, they would have discussions, and whoever is defeated would accept the winner's concept. Because he knew, he accepted that, you have the understanding better than mine, so I'll accept your understanding. Right? And not that he was defeating everybody. Shankaracharya was actually defeating the leaders, the Buddhist leaders. And when the leaders were defeated, their followers also accepted the defeat and followed Shankaracharya. And it's not that all the time Shankaracharya it's not that always they accepted the defeat and submitted themselves to Shankaracharya. Shankaracharya is his Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva has a good number of followers. Those were ghosts, hobgoblins, the bhoot prets and pishaches. So, with those, he created an army. They are known as Nagas. They go about naked. They carry a trident. So when somebody did not accept the defeat, in a gentlemanly way, then they were beaten up and driven out. So this is how Shankaracharya drove Buddhism out of India. Yes.
Why did the Kshatriyas focus on the Buddhism?
Why?
Why did the Kshatriyas more focus on the Buddhism?
Yes.
And the Pandyas mainly on the Jainism?
Yeah. You see, that trend actually started with King Ashoka. You see, King Ashoka was the king of Kalinga, which is the present-day Bihar in India. He was the king of Magad. And he had a battle with the king of Kalinga, that is Orissa. And so many people died in that battle. And he was quite tired of this battle. And so many people died. And one day, one night, he saw a Buddhist monk with a torch in his hand. He was going out and treating the wounded soldiers on the battlefield. So he was impressed. And then he started to speak to him. And he became exposed to the teachings of Lord Buddha. And then he decided not to fight anymore. You see, so he became non-violent. You see, Kshatriya, this was another setback in the Vedic culture. Because the Kshatriya should never be non-violent. Kshatriyas have to be violent. Now, if the Kshatriyas become non-violent, then who will give the protection? So, due to that trend, the kings of India, the Kshatriyas of India, started to follow Ashoka's example. And they became non-violent, they became Buddhists. And as a result of that, India actually became very weak. Prior to that, India was a very, very powerful country. And we can consider the history of India, like although there had been many, many attacks on this land from different other parts of the world, from different corners, different borders, but never ever an invader had succeeded in entering into India. Because right at the border they had been defeated and driven out. But after the Kshatriyas started to become Buddhists, there was no powerful Kshatriyas to protect the country. And then due to the influence of Kali, the kings started to fight among themselves internally. And then only the foreign invaders could enter into India. That was only, the first invader who succeeded in entering into India was only 1100 years ago. Prior to that, no invader could ever enter into India. In the history of India, we see that there was no invader who succeeded in entering into the country. On the other hand, the Indian kings, the kings of India, were actually ruling over the entire earth planet. King Parikshit was ruling over the entire earth planet. And how they would do that? Like other kings of other parts of the world were subservient to them, subordinate to them. They accepted him as the monarch. So that is how the Indian kings were ruling over the earth planet. And actually, every planet has one ultimate ruler. It's only in the Kali Yuga that system breaks down. First, there becomes many, many rulers. They become divided. They don't want to accept the authority of one supreme powerful personality on this planet. And then gradually, it ends up in democracy and communism. And then you find all third-class people become elected as the state premiers, and they pave the way to hell for everyone.
And the Vaishyas become Jains.
Vaishyas became Jains, yes. Why?
Why mainly then?
You see, generally, Kshatriyas were becoming Buddhists. So Vaishyas, many of the Vaishyas, they had their animosity or kind of grudges against the Kshatriyas. So they didn't want to actually follow Buddha, so they found a counter culture, and that was Jainism, and they followed that. But basically, when you see the teachings, they're quite similar. Both are speaking about non-violence. But the Jains are actually, Jainism is just an imitation thing. Whereas Buddhism, because it started by Buddha, the Lord himself, it has some genuine religion in it. Like as Prabhupada said, that indirectly, By following Lord Buddha, they became devotees. Indirectly. Not directly became devotees of the Lord, but they became devotees of Buddha. And Buddha is the Lord, so indirectly they became devotees. And it was only a matter of time before they were converted into the devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yes, Falguna? Beg your pardon?
Your class is very good and very short, Maharaj. Maharaj, when Ramanujacharya and Rishikani Mahaprabhu, since Ramanujacharya established Buddhism, and Vaishnavism, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is also Vaishnava, is there any gap in between that? Is there some way?
There was a gradual development. You see, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you see, there are four sampradayas. Brahma, Rudra, Shri, and Kumar. These are the four bona fide Vaishnava sampradayas. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu actually, although he accepted initiation in Brahma Madhva sampradaya, but he actually accepted, two principles from each of these four sampradayas. And that's how he established his Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Now that is one similarity that Mahaprabhu established. But ultimately they will find a difference. And the difference is that all other four sampradayas' destination, or say all other sampradayas' process of devotion, is Vaidhi Bhakti. Whereas Chaitanya Mahaprabhu established Rag Bhakti, or Raganuga Bhakti. And the destination of all other sampradayas is Vaikuntha. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu opened the gate of Golok Vrindavan. So yes, there is a difference between those Vaishnav sampradayas and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Gaudiya Vaishnavism. So that's what I am trying to actually gradually establish, that in the spiritual realm, we are the most aristocratic community. We are the greatest spiritual aristocrats. But that should not make us arrogant. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, the higher you go, more humble you become. Just like a tree, the tree, the more it becomes laden with fruits, the more it bends down. Similarly, in the spiritual life, the more one makes spiritual advancement, more one becomes enriched with spiritual qualities, the more humble he becomes. Yes, Lila Madhuri? Yes, I have to consult it. I forgot. I'll find out and give it to you. Actually, when I was presenting it, I was thinking also at the back of my mind, my God, I have to brush it up. Yes, Mother Prashanta. You see, when it comes to the point of Swarup, you know, we cannot really delve into it. You know? Like, yes, our Swarup is eternal, but what is our Swarup? We don't know. Right? As long as we are in the material platform, we won't be able to understand what our Swarup is. We'll find it out only when you go back to the spiritual sky. And when you go back to the spiritual sky, And then you'll find that our Swarup is in Golok Vrindavan or Golok Navadvip. And it's not a matter of imagination that some deviant groups actually propagate, that one can imagine his Swarup. Now, is it a matter of our mental concoction, what our Swarup is? If Swarup is Nitya Siddha Krishna, Nitya Siddhya, Nitya, eternal, then it is there. And as we cultivate spiritual process, Sankirtan, then gradually it will develop. But the fact of the matter is that when we attain, when we become elevated to the spiritual sky, due to our becoming purified, then even if we go to Vaikuntha, we will not be satisfied. Until and unless we go to Golok Vrindavan or Golok Navadvip, we won't become satisfied. Even in the spiritual Dwarka, we will not be satisfied. Just like the residents of Vrindavan, like they, when they see Krishna in Kurukshetra, when they saw Krishna in Kurukshetra, they didn't want to see Krishna in that way, as a king wearing all these royal robes and ornaments and armed with different weapons. They said, no, this is not the Krishna that we knew. Our Krishna is a cowherd boy. He wears a peacock feather, he has a flower garland, he wears a yellow silk dhoti, he tends the cows in the forest and plays flute. And due to the dissatisfaction, they started to pull his chariot. Krishna was up in the chariot to return to Dwarka from Kurukshetra after the solar eclipse. That's the time the residents of Vrindavan saw him. And they just started to pull the chariot. And that's the chariot festival. So, that is the mood of the followers of Lord Chaitanya. And in one hand, they're happy just chanting and chanting the holy name of the Lord. They're just happy glorifying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But they're not going to compromise for anything less than Golok Vrindavan. So that is, ultimately that is the Swarup of Mahaprabhu's followers. But of course that, again, one cannot get crash into Golok Vrindavan. One cannot force his way into Golok Vrindavan. That will happen by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When the Lord will desire, He will open the gate and we'll find ourselves over there. So, in course of our discussions, we'll also describe how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is actually opening the gate to Golok Vrindavan. Maybe that's what we'll discuss tomorrow. Yes?
In the course of Pralayas, we have the fact that Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and the Prabhumaras are in the list of the 12 Mahajans described in the 6th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Putting aside the fact that Lakshmi, who is the origin of the speech and brother, is the eternal servant of Krishna, why do we have one Sampradaya coming from her and she is not among the 12 Mahajans?
Yes, because she is the eternal consort of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. She is the eternal potency, the personification of the pleasure potency of the Lord. So that is the reason. Like we follow 12 Mahajans as example. It's not that only 12 Mahajans are the Mahajans. They are just classified as Mahajans. But Lakshmi Devi is the eternal consort of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that way, yes, sure. She is... who can be a greater devotee than her? Right? In a similar note, one can question, why not Radharani there in the 12 Sampradaya, 12 Mahajans, as one of the 12 Mahajans? Right? Or Vaisubal, Sridham, Vasudham, the friends of Krishna is one of the Mahajans. Because they fall in another category altogether. So that's why they haven't been included. Because these Mahajans, through their personal examples, they're setting the standard of devotion. Yes.
What contribution did Madhavacharya have to the development of Vaishnavism?
Beg your pardon?
What contribution did Madhavacharya have to the development of Vaishnavism?
Oh, yeah. You see, Ramanujacharya established Vishishtadvaitavad. And then Madhvacharya came and he actually gave a tremendous thrust on spreading of Vaishnavism with his extraordinary spiritual potency. And what Ramanujacharya established, in his own way it is, of course, you know, it is complete, but Madhvacharya gave, in a way we can say that, even more complete understanding. You see, in Vishishtadvaitavad, it is established that that the spiritual reality is one, but there is variety. But Madhvacharya, he defined that variety even more. The duality, the concept of duality through Madhvacharya became more prominent. So that is how one aspect. And another thing is that, like, you see, Ramanujacharya, like for example, we can say, like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur spread Krishna consciousness. But then Prabhupada came and gave a bigger thrust to his preaching. Similarly, Madhvacharya came and gave a bigger thrust into the works of Ramanujacharya, or rather, establishing Vaishnavism in India. But Ramanujacharya gets a lot of credit because the way, you know, his mission was very difficult because it was, at that time, India was practically became impersonal, you know, under the big wave of impersonalism. But Ramanujacharya came and just fought against that and established the Vaishnava culture. Whereas Madhvacharya found that the field was quite created. Okay, it's already 5 past. Sorry, Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.